This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, local writer and journalist Melanie Sen talks about her new novel.
I felt like I discovered Murray Hall. And here was this very well-researched article about Hall's life.
Also, Fort Hunter Liggett is leading the energy independence charge with microgrids.
We're the first garrison, first installation to establish a microgrid that's based solely on renewable energies, solar power.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 7th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with a look at the San Luis Obispo Women's Rugby Club. They celebrate 20 years of breaking barriers on the Central Coast. Here's reporter Alyssa Toledo.
Women's rugby is one of the fastest growing sports in the world, with over 2.7 million female players globally, making up more than a quarter of the total playing population, according to World Rugby.
Alone Amar, the hands in the air. They've done what no other American rugby team in sevens have ever done before.
This year, after the U.S. women's rugby team snagged a bronze medal at the Olympics and star player Alone Amar took over Instagram to empower women in sports media, it felt like a good time to check in with SLO Women's Rugby as they celebrate their 20th anniversary. Lindsay Graff, the team's founder, looks back on the early days with pride. The inception of the team was her senior project at Cal Poly.
The men's team kept saying, "You can't keep playing with us. We need to start a women's team. We'll help you do it, but it's time."
Graff and fellow player Amanda Weissen had dreams of establishing a women's rugby team at Cal Poly, but the university wasn't exactly receptive to the idea.
Poly didn't want us. We're like, screw it, we're going to just start our own team.
That resilient, we'll do it ourselves attitude is central to the culture of women's rugby. As Graff sees it, quote, "Rugby culture is inherently inclusive, welcoming players of all types, sizes, shapes, and temperaments." Graff says that for many, rugby is more than just a sport. It's a place where they not only belong, but are embraced. Morgan Mollis, a veteran player and tight head prop, which is a forward position, joined the team after high school. She says rugby was the first environment where she saw being queer as something to be celebrated rather than hidden. For her and many others, rugby offers not only a place to play, but also to grow, to feel safe, and to be their authentic selves.
I feel like there's a whole generation of us who wanted to play football, but they said girls can't do it. It was just another obstacle or something to get around at that point. It's like, okay, well, they don't want us. We'll go over here. They're like, we just want to play.
The team began by posting flyers in the women's locker rooms and borrowing oversized jerseys from the SLO Men's Rugby Club. 20 years later, Graff reflects on the moment when the first official Cal Poly women's team, led by some of SLO Women's Rugby's current players like Elena Strum and Mollis, hit the field.
Mollis, come on!
And the first year that I saw the Cal Poly women put on Cal Poly jerseys and play, I cried.
Though the team established itself in 2016 as a club sport, they didn't begin playing official league matches until 2018.
And that actually took 2 years until we were able to enter into a league. So in 2018, I became the president of the team, and that's when we had to have a conversation with SLO Women's and say, we love you guys, thank you so much for welcoming us into your club, but we want to try to actually enter into a league and make our team official. So that's what we did.
The Cal Poly team is now entering its 9th official year and holds the title of D2 National Spring Champions. Meanwhile, SLO Women's Rugby Club is currently preparing for their upcoming 15 season, requiring 15 players and several substitutes for an 80-minute match. When asked what keeps women coming back to the sport despite full-time jobs, families, and other responsibilities, Strum's response was simple.
I think rugby is the biggest confidence booster for women that there is. Confidence in themselves in life, and then confidence in their body and what their body's capable of.
The team recently celebrated its 20th anniversary at Tri-Tips, the largest sevens tournament on the West Coast. They are looking ahead to the next 20 years and eager to share their love of the sport with future generations of women.
Just try it out. I think come out to a practice and see how you like it. A lot of people are pleasantly surprised with how they can perform and how much fun it is and how much of a welcoming community we have.
You can follow the team on Instagram at Slow Women's Rugby. And for KCBX News, I'm Melissa Toledo.
This reporting is made possible by a grant from the Shanbrom Family Foundation. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, local writer and freelance reporter Melanie Sen talks with Brian Reynolds about her new book, Murray, a Novel.
Thanks, welcome, Brian. Melanie.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
The name Murray Hall, although it's historically accurate name of a real person in history, it's kind of mysterious, and we're going to delve into some of that mystery today. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this particular book?
Yeah. First of all, I taught at Cal Poly for many, many years, but I kind of stumbled across Murray as a grad student at Cal Poly in the English department. I was writing a paper. I was writing an essay about Walt Whitman and kind of the gayness in his poetry that I'd kind of discovered. And I probably used a word like homoerotic, you know, because it was the English department. And while I was doing that research, I came across a book called Gay American History, written by a gentleman named Jonathan Ned Katz. And in that book, he kind of talked about historical figures, women who had lived as men. He talked about Walt Whitman quite a bit. And there were just a few pages about Murray Hall, but I read those pages and it was like a light bulb went off in my head. I just became almost obsessed with finding out everything I could. I flew to New York City. I went to the public library, and this was 20 years ago. So these articles were on, you know, microfiche, looking them up. I printed everything I could find, and there were just a handful of newspaper articles about Murray Hall, namely after his death, because once he died, it was discovered that Murray Hall was not born a man.
Just out of curiosity, and referring to this history book, how much of that history was contemporary? In other words, is it drawn from writings or other statements that the gay Americans made, or is it second or third parties writing about them at a later date?
You know, I found nothing about Murray Hall except the original articles that were published in the 1800s, and he died in 1901. So those articles were the only thing that I found until there was a woman named Karen Abbott, and I had already been well into writing the manuscript, and she wrote an article in the Smithsonian about Murray Hall. And that was a little bit shocking for me because I felt like I discovered Murray Hall. And here was this very well-researched article about Hall's life. And I ended up reaching out to Karen Abbott and letting her know that I was writing a book about, you know, Murray.
And it took you many years, correct, to do this?
I was writing the novel over about 15 years. I was teaching at Cal Poly in the English department, so I always had a massive stack of papers waiting for me to grade. So I just carved out as much time as I could, and it just took a really, really long time to finish it. I was, you know, running a household, raising two children, and I would on occasion just shelf the manuscript because I would just get overwhelmed with teaching and parenting. And I couldn't leave it. I just kept coming back to it. And every time I came back to it and read what I had written, I just felt reinvigorated and finally finished it.
It was, I think you would warn me or promise me, it was a page-turner. And I was so impressed with the meticulous scholarship that went into this. Murray's trajectory from Scotland to New York City, 1850 approximately, until 1900, about 50 years, intersects with some really important eras in history, such as the Civil War and draft riots. Let's talk about the book. Who was Murray Hall?
So I'm glad to hear you kind of note that kind of historical, the historical references. For me, it was almost like doing a dissertation. I mean, just to write the few paragraphs when Murray goes to see her brother in Bellevue in the hospital, you know, I would read an entire book to just be able to write a couple pages about Bellevue Hospital. But that was a labor of love for me. In fact, at some point I had to say, I put a little sticky note up that said, you know, research is not writing, because it was so much fun to research, and I wanted to make sure that I was incorporating that. So Murray Hall was born in Scotland in Govan, which is near Glasgow, in 1840. And there's evidence that Murray was born in 1840, yes, but emigrated in 1846 as a child. There's also evidence that Murray did not come to New York until he was older, until he was about maybe in his 20s. So my original draft of the novel kind of imagined Murray coming to New York already as a young adult and already wanting to live as a man. You know, one of the first things I have in the novel is the census. It's the very beginning in the prologue. It says the census record for June 11th, 1900. It's where Murray lives. Surname Hall, given Murray H, sex M for male, born February 1840, status widow. And it says immigrated 1846. So that is the story that Murray told the census people. And so I went with that. I went with Murray arriving in, they emigrated to Canada. They wanted to go to New York, the family, but they ended up going to Canada. It was a little bit cheaper. And Murray and Murray's brother coming down from Canada to New York City as orphans, essentially at that point. But Murray was born a girl. Murray was born Mary Anderson, grew up as a girl, decided to dress as a boy once she got to New York City, and it was very dangerous. She was a young girl in New York City, orphaned and very vulnerable. She and her brother were trying to make their way. It was safer, frankly, for her to dress as a boy, to move through the city as a male. Also, you know, I imagine Murray having that proclivity already for being a tomboy. And I write about that, about kind of her emulation of her brother, essentially.
Yeah, her brother was her protector. And I think it's a significant bit of history, real history, that immigrants who came, in her case from Scotland, many came from Ireland, but they came on ships. You could call them cruise ships of a sort. There was a certain type of passenger that had a decent voyage and good food, but there was many people, the poorer class, not just brutal, but fatal diseases spreading because of lack of sanitation. So I don't know if that story is well known.
Yeah, they were called coffin ships because it was, you know, the steerage passengers were down below. They were packed in so tightly. And many of them, like you say, were Irish people escaping the potato famine. And so, you know, they made this passage to the United States or into Canada, and many, many people died. I actually went to Grosse Isle, where these ships would have landed in Canada and on the St. Lawrence River. And those ships landing there, you know, the passengers, many of them had died along the way, and many of them were quarantined there on Grosse Isle and died of typhus, you know, died of cholera.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you selected a reading or two that we can enjoy?
I do have a reading. And one of the readings that I thought I would start with was kind of when Murray learns, when she's a girl, she learns that her family is going to go to America. Murray is kind of reflecting back. The way that the manuscript is kind of written is Murray kind of writing his life story. And so this is kind of Murray describing himself as a girl. I was a tomboy, a scrapper, and my mother was tolerant of this because I was young and she probably did not have the energy to keep me in line and try to make me behave in a more ladylike manner. Or maybe she just loved me and let me be myself. But I was not totally ignorant. Looking around at older girls, I saw my fate. Most were prim and reserved, spick and span. And the women, mostly housebound with chores that never finished, the same tasks over and over, day in and day out, milk the cow, tend the garden, wash and mend the clothes, clean the hearth, prepare the meals. The relentless chores of women never changed. That life seemed like a drudgery to me, a fate to try to escape if possible, but I had no idea how. I observed that men, in contrast, went out into the world. There was simply more variety to their lives, more opportunity. They had the option of all the different trades and businesses open to them and the possibility of going to university, all the subjects a man could study, all the things he could become. Men practiced law or became doctors or professors. Men ran shops and had businesses. They built things like roads, buildings, ships. That's what I learned early on. Men lived one life, women another. Maybe it would be different in America, I thought. Maybe women had more opportunities there. Anyway, I was a child. What did I know?
I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by local author, first novelist, Melanie Sen, with her novel, Murray. Just a fascinating page-turner that I encourage everyone to read. One of the interesting things about this book to me, Melanie, is that it seesaws the reader back between things that are exquisitely beautiful or funny, a droll humor, a lot of it, as the French call it. But the challenges, the misery that people faced in those times, not just because of poverty, but because of ethnic discrimination. Italians were treated badly. I think at one point they were people from Eastern Europe were called the sweepings of the trash bins, you know, that were coming to our shores. What really struck me is reflected in the passage you just read and which we alluded to earlier is that women were, I'm not sure second-class citizens is even maybe shows up. It's more like third or fourth in terms of the control of their own lives, their own bodies, the ability to make a living. Murray Hall, as a young entrepreneur, male entrepreneur, had a variety of things. If they showed up and they had grit and they maybe could compromise their principles a little bit, because Murray did get involved with some political backroom, you know, things going on with Tammany Hall, but made a conscious choice, or maybe the only choice that he could have made, if he wanted to have any kind of a life other than drudgery and penury, which is a great word, poverty, he had to be a man. And what do you think that has that changed in modern society? Because in many cases, or at least in certain communities, I don't think it has.
I think that there are obviously a lot more opportunities for women. I think statistically, more women now are enrolled in college. And so there's definitely, we see, you know, more women CEOs. We see a lot of barriers being broken through. But again, we also see women kind of stripped of their agency. You know, I mean, Roe v. Wade was overturned. That was a 50-year precedent. So women, you know, have in many states have lost their reproductive rights. And, you know, I think that without reproductive rights, women cannot be equal citizens. And so in some ways, it feels like we're just going backwards.
I have read that these are anthropology experts, anthropological experts talking that if humanity can achieve one thing that would be a sort of a proxy silver bullet for a lot of social problems, it is nothing more complicated or less simple than allowing a woman to plan her pregnancies or not. You know, I know I'm not going to get pregnant. I'm not going to have children. And or I'd like to have 10 or two. But it's as though because it takes two to create a baby, human baby. It's as though the man is not part of the equation at all. I mean, certainly he's there in the background, but it's the woman's fault. It's the woman's responsibility. But if that were true, if we really believe that, we would put her in charge, wouldn't we?
I like to think so. Yes, for sure.
Kind of startling. How about another reading?
Sure. So Marie dresses as a boy when he's a child. Then when he becomes an adolescent, he has to go back to being Mary again, to being a girl. And so he's kind of adopted by – not adopted actually, but just befriended by a woman named Harriet. He has a few friends who are Harriet is one of them, sorry. She works for a man named Reverend Pease, who's trying to kind of save the poor. And Harriet, when discovers that Marie has been dressing as a boy that really needs to be a girl, kind of nudges Marie into being a girl again and helping out at the House of Industry, which Reverend Pease runs. And so that's what Marie's doing, Mary, at that point. When her friend Emma gives her a book, and it's Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And this Mary, I guess I would say, Mary going back and forth between Marie and Mary. Mary is now 15 years old, receives this gift from her friend Emma. And so Walt Whitman plays kind of a large part in this book. I was born in Camden, New Jersey. It's the resting place of Walt Whitman. And so Marie reads aloud the poem Song of Myself. And Marie had been raised with poetry, his mother reading poetry to him when he was a child. And so he's kind of discovering Walt Whitman as an American poet. And the lines from A Song of Myself are, "You must habit yourself to the dazzle of the light and every moment of your life. Long have you timidly waited, holding a plank by the shore. Now I will you to be a bold swimmer, to jump off in the midst of the sea and rise again and nod to me and shout and laughingly dash with your hair." And Marie says, "Can you imagine what those words meant to me? It was an invitation to live, to be fully oneself, to delight in one's surroundings, to drink in life, to celebrate its fullness. I had loved my Wordsworth and my Burns and would never forsake them. But here was a poet for me, in America, in New York City. I even found answers about God here, because Whitman did not renounce God, but saw him everywhere, in every object, and yet still saw himself as more wonderful, delightful blaspheme. Never had I felt such energy or hope. I didn't know whether to cry or laugh. I wanted to run the streets, to test them out in this new vision, to see the city anew through Whitman's eyes. How would I have to live with such openness, empathy, and vulnerability, to experience so much exaltation and so much suffering, and to not turn away from any of it? That's what it would mean to me to be fully alive. It would be as if I were taking a first step on a very long and exciting journey."
We're almost out of time, and a theme that we haven't covered, and I promise you, as I did yesterday on the phone, we're going to do round two on this, the whole issue of growing up transgender or not non-binary, whatever the terminology is. It is something which could and should be, in my view, celebrated, not stigmatized. And our role as a society, a caring society, should be to hold that person close to our heart and let them know that we're here for them. And we want to be supportive of that. Because these people have so much, not just a life to live that they deserve. The fact that there was a person like Marie Hall and that we know about him and her and his challenges and what he accomplished is just amazing to me. And I felt refreshed after I read the book. I felt encouraged and hopeful more. Now, before we end, Where can people get this book?
It's on Amazon.
It is on Amazon.
Yeah, you can get paperback or Kindle version on Amazon.
I urge people to do it. And then when you're ready for book discussions, book signings, please give me a call. I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by first novelist and local author Melanie Sen to discuss her new book, Murray. I highly recommend it. Thank you, Melanie.
Thank you so much, Brian.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Fort Hunter Liggett is leading the energy independence charge with microgrids. KCBX's Tom Wilmer recently attended the ribbon-cutting ceremony.
Fort Hunter Liggett, U.S. Army Reserve Garrison in Monterey County, continues to lead the way in the Army's energy resilience. It's the first ever military installation with a microgrid implementation using only renewable sources, such as photovoltaic generation and battery storage. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. I attended the Fort Hunter Liggett ribbon-cutting ceremony September 17th, where we met with the Honorable Rachel Jacobson, Assistant Secretary of the Army Pentagon for Installations, Energy, and Environment. Naomi Gallardo, Commissioner, California Energy Commission, and Colonel Trotter, Fort Hunter Liggett Base Commander. Come along and join the conversation.
I'm Rachel Jacobson, Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment.
And where are you based?
I'm based in Washington at the Pentagon, so it's a pleasure to be here in California.
I bet. What a change. Yeah.
Oh, it's a big change, but this is a really special occasion, and we're just thrilled to be a part of it and to congratulate Fort Hunter Liggett on this incredible accomplishment.
Talk to us about your primary mission, even personally. What is closest to your heart? What are you most impassioned with and about?
We want to make sure that we provide installations that give soldiers the readiness they need to be the best warfighters in the world, as well as good quality of life. And part of a resilient installation is energy resilience. And that's what we're doing here at Fort Hunter Liggett.
So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Noemi Gallardo. I'm a commissioner at the California Energy Commission. Really excited to celebrate with the Army. Fort Hunter Liggett has reached a major milestone with their microgrid here. And we're excited to celebrate this milestone because it's helping California achieve its goal of getting to an 100% clean energy future using renewables.
And I understand this is really a trendsetter nationwide. It's the largest microgrid United States Army, right?
Absolutely. I mean, just being here in person, you know, looking up, looking across, it's extensive. So again, exciting to get us to a clean energy future. And what that also means for the military is increasing its ability to defend our nation, not having to depend on fuels that, you know, may run out or that we can't get a hold of. Really excited to be here for that.
A little bit more about your mission and your primary focus, what you work on.
Absolutely. So the California Energy Commission is the lead state entity for energy policy and planning for the state of California. And our mission is to get to an 100% clean energy future for all Californians. So we work on forecasting, data analysis, we do investments with grants, loans, and a plethora of other policy movements and actions to help ensure we get to that 100% clean energy future.
Right here, we're underneath a grid of solar panels.
Yes.
I mean, mega. How big an area does this cover? It's huge.
It is huge. I'm looking out, and it seems to not end. This is fantastic, and it's going to be able to give the Army a lot more ability to do its job and do it really well.
It's one thing to have a solar array, but as you well know, it's storage.
Yes.
So how does that work?
You're right. So solar is great for generating power, but it can only generate power as long as the sun's out, and the sun can't be out 24 hours. So energy storage is an excellent way to store that additional power and then be able to dispatch it when it's needed, when the sun's not out. So it just elongates that power and enables, you know, entities like the military to be able to use that when they need it and not be stuck during an outage.
Talk to us for a moment, if you can, about wind. I know there's the offshore wind energy initiative off the California coast, and then you have all those wind generators, you know, Altamont Pass. And talk to us about wind.
Yeah, so wind is another renewable that is an exciting arena. So we've had onshore wind that's on land for a long time. There are installations in different areas throughout California. And so the wind is helpful because usually it is moving when the sun isn't necessarily out. So it gives us even more clean power. Offshore wind is something new for California, so it'll take a while to achieve offshore wind, but we're learning from our peers out on the East Coast and then also in different countries. That offshore wind will be even, I think, more transformative than onshore wind has been because it will generate even more power.
To learn more about your world, a website, a go-to?
Absolutely. So I'd encourage you to go to energy.ca.gov. That's our website, and there's a ton of information there on all the policy areas that we're covering, including offshore wind and the military efforts that we've done as well that we've invested in. My name is Noemi, N-O-E-M-I, Gallardo, G-A-L-L-A-R-D-O. I'm with the California Energy Commission, one of the five commissioners there.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm Colonel Stephen Trotter. I'm the garrison commander for Fort Hunter Liggett. I reign from Indianapolis, Indiana, and proud to call Fort Hunter Liggett my home right now, along with my wife and my son, who's off in college. Enjoy being here at Fort Hunter Liggett. And like I said during my comments, it's been a real honor to take the helm and lead us into the commissioning of this microgrid today.
It really is a trendsetter of any Army installation in America, isn't it?
It is. It is. And like was mentioned during the ribbon cutting ceremony, although there are a number of microgrids going up across many of the installations and municipalities, as far as Department of Defense goes, we're the first garrison, first installation to establish a microgrid that's based solely on renewable energies, solar power. Wow. Many of the other microgrids are both solar and also combine some petro or carbon-based generation. We are solely based on solar and in battery backup.
It really is a model.
It is. It's a model, and it's being emulated hereafter. We are amongst the first to start working on microgrids, and this is the second microgrid that we've actually had here, so it's been quite a privilege and an honor to be here and be part of this.
Colonel Trotter, thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett.
This is KCBX Public Radio. We recently held our pledge drive, and we almost met our goal, but not quite. So we have just a little bit of time left before we are going to close it out. And we do need your help to meet our goal for our budget for the year. If you haven't donated yet, you can do so now at kcbx.org. This is Issues and Ideas. Pete Kelly, owner of the Pete's Central Coast Restaurants from 1977 to 2007, has written a cookbook. In this interview from our archives, recorded in fall of 2022, I talked with Pete Kelly about his travels, books written, and that famous red enchilada sauce. My guest today is author, historian, and restaurateur Pete Kelly. And the name may sound familiar from Pete's Seaside in Avila Beach from around 1977 to 1988. And then Pete Kelly owned Pete's Southside, that was in Railroad Square, and Pete's Pierside, Avila Beach. And what you might not know, in 2013, Pete co-wrote Avila Beach, part of the Images of America series. In 2016, he wrote a book of his travels called The Long Road South, Vagabond Diaries, 1971-72. Then in 2020, he published the local history book, The Quick and the Dead, Resistance, Banditry, and Vigilance, Revisited on the Central Coast. And what I have right here, I have Pete Kelly's latest book, and it's a cookbook, and it's called A Taste of Pete's Southside Cafe, San Luis Obispo. Pete, welcome to Issues and Ideas.
Well, thank you, Carol.
It's good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
I was very excited when I heard you had a cookbook, being one of those many people who spent a lot of time at Pete's Southside.
Well, thank you. And people would always ask me for recipes. And so I'd go, well, you're going to have to buy my cookbook. But I didn't have a cookbook. And then finally I said, well, if we don't do a cookbook, all our customers and ourselves will all be gone. Pat Elkins, my kitchen manager from Pete's in San Luis, and I wrote this book.
It's good. I've already sampled some recipes. Now, you have some history with KCBX.
Oh, yeah, from the very beginning. When KCBX started, I think we started sponsoring things, and we would give away things on Pledge Week, sponsored the Evening Blues with Bill Kiley. And once I moved to San Luis Obispo, we started doing the annual brunch for the people that pledged a dollar a day. Then I cooked at the very first Live Oak, which was at Biddle Park in Arroyo Grande. And then I had a food booth built and started serving food at Live Oak in Santa Barbara. That was really fun. And then one time a volunteer said, could you expand your menu? And I said, do I look like a carnival worker to you?
That was the end of that, right?
That was the end of that, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Frank Lanzone, general manager here, he says that he was first here from the Bay Area, I think. Steve Burrell took him to your first place in Avila.
Right.
And he said that you and Steve were yelling at each other and that there were a bunch of local surfers eating and a bunch of business people at a table. And he just thought, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing in those days with Barbara by the Sea and Pete's Seaside. Really different.
Old Avila. And yep. In your restaurant, Pete's Southside, I feel like you had one of those wonderful pictures, like someone had taken a panorama of all
right,
the people.
Right, that was called Avila Awake, and it was done by Mike Monahan. He did this before computers, so he took actually 5,000 pictures of the sidewalk and Front Street and scissored them all together, and that became Avila Awake.
Oh.
Yeah, so I have that at the CSD office in Avila right now, and we do copies of that for people and then use the money to fund our history project we have going in Avila.
Great.
Basically, that's Front Street 1980.
Yeah, very different than today.
Yes.
We're going to get to the cookbook, but I have to start first with The Long Road South, The Vagabond Diaries, you and a guy named Steve.
Steve Slaughter, local electrician.
Yeah, basically just went south and you jumped onto trains, you ate where you could, sometimes you worked for food. The history that I learned about Central and South America in that book was fascinating. But at the same time, it was such a great road trip. I mean, I lived vicariously, through your journey.
Yeah, I think that's really a good book. I mean, people read that and tell me, God, I loved that book. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get it out there. I ordered 500 copies, self-published. And after I broke even, which I never even expected to do, then my motivation for selling books kind of waned as I went into other books. But that book still sells. And see, the only place you can get it is basically from me.
Oh, you don't want to put
Peggy
it in some...
Peggy was selling it at her photo shop.
Right.
I don't know if she's out of it. And I believe they have copies at the History Center. But mainly what they're selling is The Quick and the Dead.
Which is also fun.
Yeah, it is.
Crazy
but that's
stuff.
A documented history. That's very, very important to this county. It kind of sheds light on that committee of vigilance that hung everybody in Mission Plaza.
Yeah, those aren't history stories that I had ever heard of before.
Those aren't history stories they want you to hear of.
We're going to get back to the cookbook, but I'm just going to read just a little bit here, and this is from The Long Road South, Vagabond Diaries. This is in your epilogue. Upon returning home, after almost 2 years pursuing the fine art of goofing off, reality raised its ugly head, and my travel companions and I all had to find work. having been influenced by Pablo Neruda's Towards the Splendid City, as well as by other writings and experiences, I chose to work with my hands, so I became a cook. I had become accustomed to fresh local food and fish, and often I was able to watch and talk with the cooks as they did their thing. This kind of experience wasn't really available in the States at that time, and I fantasized about recreating a place like that at home.
Which that is, happened.
Yeah. So you started in Avila.
I started in Avila, right.
In what, 1977?
Actually, my first cooking job was in Avila in 73 at the Old Port Inn.
That's where you were washing dishes?
I started out washing dishes, right. And the next day I came in and they made me a cook.
Yeah, it didn't take long, I guess.
No.
Well, you know, a lot of us spent a lot of time, I will say, at Pete's Southside Cafe. And the tables, I remember they were packed real tightly. And it was noisy and delicious. And I think a lot of people share those same memories.
Yeah, they do. And doing this book is really fun because I've run into a lot of my former customers and former employees, and we've had a lot of fun reminiscing.
Well, the pictures in here are fun, too. I actually cooked some of the recipes out of your cookbook. I made the green enchilada sauce. I made the plantains. I had help with the plantains, the tostones.
The tostones.
Yes, tostones. The red sauce, the gazpacho. I made shrimp enchiladas and your black beans and rice. And shared them with friends. A couple of people even said, oh my gosh, this takes me back.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And it's, you know, we had to break those things down from a pot of enchilada sauce that had 400 servings in it to enchilada sauce for 8 people, you know. So there was a lot of math involved in it. But it's really good when people tried it and it turns out good because a lot of times, you know, I didn't ever write down a lot of this stuff, and neither Pat, and we just pulled it out of our hat, and it turned out really good.
Did any ingredients have to go by the wayside? Cooking for a home kitchen, it was like, oh, we can't use that because people just don't buy that? Or did you keep the recipes authentic to the restaurant piece?
Yeah, they were authentic to the restaurant. When I first started in Avila, we had to put up a sign saying, we serve black beans, because people would go, what's this? This black thing on my plate? Because no one was serving them. Of course, now everybody serves black beans.
Yeah.
That was the same with putting cilantro in a salad. We would put cilantro in salads and people wouldn't know what that taste was. And ceviche fish tacos. Someone did an article in the paper saying I served the first fish taco in Central California. So it's really funny because now you go to any restaurant in the world and you can get black beans, fish taco, and ceviche. But right. At the time, I was the only one doing that. They were doing it in Guatemala, but
yeah, it was really different to have that here. So there are different pictures throughout the book. A picture of, you know, a bunch of surfers that were some of your first customers.
Yeah, my first customers in Avila were the local surfers. You know, Miss Barbara said, paint the inside pink. And I did it because she was my landlady, but it turned out that's really a good background color for all the stuff we hung on the wall. We hung a lot of Caribbean stuff on the wall, so I think some of the Avila locals thought we were hippie voodoo people. The surfers recognized what we were doing right away, and the Avila local surfers were my best and first customers.
Maybe they had done some traveling.
They'd done some traveling.
And chasing waves further south.
That was pretty cool because I was a surfer myself. And when I wasn't working, I would like to be in the ocean. Yeah, it worked out perfect.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio with a favorite interview from our archives from the fall of 2022 with Pete Kelly. How are you getting the word out about your cookbook?
Well, only on Facebook and word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it was just all word of mouth.
Is it a silly question to ask why you don't approach the local bookshops?
Well, if we do a second printing, we will. But on the first printing, we wanted to sell it for the $25. That way we could make our printing costs, our formatting costs, all that stuff. And then when you put it in all the local bookstores, they get their cut. So instead of making $25 a book, you make maybe 12.
Okay.
So that's the reason. Now, we have to decide, because they're going to go fast, what's left, and we're going to have to decide whether we're going to do another round of books. I know, like on the Long Road South, I ordered 500 books not knowing how I was going to sell them or anything, and I probably got 200 left. So you got to be careful on how many books you order.
Getting back to the cookbook, what I noticed is a lot of the ingredients, I feel like a lot of the local ingredients that a lot of us use in cooking all the time, the olive oil, the lemon juice, the cilantro, onion, cumin, or do you say cumin?
You can say cumino, you can say cumin, you can say cumin.
Is that intentional when you make a cookbook so people can access the ingredients, or is that pretty much the way these recipes are always cooked?
That's the way we always cooked them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think in there it's talking about how I came up with a Caribbean dinner, which is a really funny story.
Tell the story.
Okay, well, in Punta Gorda in Belize, there's a ferry boat that goes to Guatemala. So I was sitting in this little village at the time. I hear it's changed. This is 50 years ago. And it was just it was a British colony, so out around town, there were Hindu people growing rice. In the center of town, it was all Caribbean people, Afro-Indian people that were the shop owners. And they just had these little wooden houses on pilings, and it was very neat and wonderful. And I was walking around, and I saw a hand-painted sign that said, Mon Mon's Five-Star Cafe, visited by Duncan Hines. And so I went, well, I'm going to eat there. There's no doubt about that.
Yes.
So I go up, and there's this big Carib guy cutting up a snapper with a machete. And you must be Mon Mon. Yeah. And I want to eat here. Well, come back at 5 and you'll have dinner. So I came back. It was just me and Mon Mon. His dining room sat 4. And he goes, you're going to travel all over the world, but you're never going to eat food as good as Mon Mon's. And so I did, and it was true, but he did black beans, rice, a salad made out of not lettuce, but cabbage, plantains, and fish. And so I called that a Caribbean dinner and put it on the menu. And it ended up on the menu as like a poor man's dinner, almost. In other words, you could get a complete dinner, but at the time it was really reasonable. So you got, the whole color palette in that Caribbean dinner. So that was a pretty funny. But I don't know if I used the same thing that Mon Mon used. But anyway.
Maybe part of, like you say, a poor man's meal, but maybe that has, I don't know, more to do with just using what's local than duplicating exactly.
Yeah.
What you found there.
Yeah. That's what I was doing. I wasn't really duplicating.
Yeah, yeah. And you had all that fresh fish.
Oh, yeah. And it was a lot different in those days. At my cafe in Avila, I could get a 10-pound bag of rock cod fillets, local fresh, which people call snapper, but it's not. It's rock cod. And for 80 cents a pound, so for $8, I would get a 10-pound bag of fish. Now, first of all, you can't get local fish that fresh. And if you could, it would be at least $8 a pound. So the price has gone up, tenfold.
Well, and you probably went through that fish at the restaurants, too.
Oh, yeah, fast.
Yes.
I'd worked at the Old Port, and their wholesale fish company was supplying my fish. So I knew everybody there. So when I called up to order fish, that was a priority, and they would just run it to Avila, which really worked out well.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio with a favorite interview from our archives from the fall of 2022 with Pete Kelly. Pete has come up with a cookbook. Looking at the recipes in the book, some of them are very authentic, like here's one for at the menudo, where you say 1 pound of cow's feet washed.
Right. Yep. that menudo was definitely the real thing.
Yeah. What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite recipe in here? I know that's hard. It's like, you know, asking a mom to choose between her kids.
My favorite, I don't know if it translates well to a home kitchen. It's probably tougher. But I like the mariscotta, and then I like the gumbo. And we would win at Mardi Gras.
You know, there was always
a gumbo cook-off.
Yeah.
Pat cooked some of the best gumbo I've ever eaten. Mm. And, of course, the mariscotta was just to die for. But, you know, there's a lot in there. Besides just recipes, there's good advice, I think.
Well, in stories, too.
Right.
You and Pat tell good stories. You each had an interesting background, and he was your chef. What can you tell us real quickly about Pat, Pat Elkins?
Well, he came from Dos Palos in the San Joaquin Valley. He moved to the coast, and I was kitchen manager when Tortilla Flats first opened, and I hired Pat. And then he went on to be the chef at Jane Brolin's cafe she had in San Luis for a while. I forget the name.
It was on the creek, right, on Broad Street.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And then he started a restaurant in Cayucas, Reina del Mar, and that is where that famous smoked fish place was years later. And it was a famous smoked fish place. Well, that's where Pat first started out.
This cookbook itself felt like, well, it felt like a history book from an era that a lot of us remember.
Yeah.
The picture of Miss Barbara, looks like Finney Smith took that picture. You know, she and Finney Smith were both characters at Avila Beach at that time.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really a nice book. It has a spiral cover. Are you thinking of doing a hardbound or?
Well, you know, Joni Hunt, who is our formatter, she said, oh, bind it, because pages stay open. You know these cookbooks that you have to buy a plastic stand to stick them in? The front, if you spill enchilada sauce on it, you can wipe it off with a towel.
It's convenient.
Yeah, it's convenient, and it's usable, you know, rather than a cookbook sitting on the shelf.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was why it's bound and why it's that way. My email is Pedro Kelly, that's K-E-L-L-E-Y, at gmail.com.
Well, Pete Kelly, this has been, it's been so fun to talk to you about this book.
Thank you.
A favorite interview from our archives from the fall of 2022. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. A Morro Bay ceramicist blends sculpting with jazz. KCBX's Aidan Dillon reports.
Morro Bay artist Ross Hale speaks of a vision. He's walking down a dark city street late at night when he hears the faint sound of music. It draws him down a stairway, through a door, and into a room where an 8-piece jazz band is performing on stage. Hale offers this vision as context to his most recent artistic endeavor, the jazz band. The collection of 8 ceramic sculptures of musicians is on display in the front window of Full Moon Studio and Gallery in Morro Bay, owned by Hale and his wife Hetty. The jazz band's debut this summer was the culmination of 2 years and nearly 2,000 hours of work. It's a milestone for Hale, as the first time he's fused his artistic passions of ceramics and jazz.
This work really pushed my personal limits of almost 60 years of working in clay. And I found that exciting to be on the edge of the cliff with no safety nets. And then I'm so happy with the way the work came out.
Hale took a risky approach by raku firing his ceramic sculptures. The raku firing technique is unpredictable and can often result in the ceramics being destroyed. When the technique is successful, it removes oxygen from the clay, giving the piece a matte black color, as seen in Hale's jazz band sculptures.
A lot of people wouldn't be willing to risk hundreds of hours on a firing. And easily, and I have seen it often in my career, there's nothing. You've lost it. So you just got to get your spirits back together and go for it again.
Even before he began work on the jazz band, Hale said he had long wanted to create something that spoke to the themes of technical proficiency and artistic independence in jazz.
And so what I wanted to express here in my work was the intensity of concentration it takes to master your instrument, and yet at the same time, there's a certain freedom that comes once you're not worried about your instrument.
Hale also wanted to express his love of jazz with this work. In the 1960s, when many of his peers were listening to rock and roll, Hale bought his first LP, Kinda Blue, by Miles Davis.
And what I always loved was how far they could travel and yet come back to that same melody that we all heard at the very beginning. And it seemed like magic. It still does.
That was in high school, and Hale says he was inspired to begin playing music himself. He picked up the flute and harmonica just for fun and still plays alongside friends. When Hale began working on the jazz band, the singer was the first character that formed in his mind. She wears a vibrant tomato red dress that separates her from the rest of the band.
But then as you look into the background and you see all the other band members contributing and also stars in their own right. And in fact, that was very, very important to me because these people are all just as critical as her, even though she is the star.
With the bulk of the work behind him, Hale is now looking for a new home for the sculptures. He insists on keeping them together as a complete work.
I don't want to break the band up. And this is a group. It is a single collection. It is a unique moment, 2 years in the making, will not be replicated.
Hale says he'd like to see the band going on display in a music room, recording studio, or a museum or gallery of jazz.
That's the part that I'm most excited to see this band go out and find a larger venue and an audience. And I hope that they will see that love of music, that communication of love of music, as they see the pieces in total.
For now, until that new gig emerges, Hale's Jazz Band will be holding the stage at the Full Moon Gallery in Morro Bay. For KCBX News, I'm Aiden Dillon.
This reporting is made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation, San Luis Obispo County. And finally, in honor of Arts and Humanities Month in October, the City of San Luis Obispo is bringing back Arttober to uplift San Luis Obispo's incredible arts and humanities organizations. All kinds of things to do this month, from film and cinema to murals and modern art, live performances. Each week of the month, a nonprofit organization will be highlighted online at visitslo.com to bring more awareness to the important work they do and the value they bring to the community. And one of the really popular things that for the second year in a row, Piano in the Plaza. Throughout the month of October, Mission Plaza will be home to an upright piano. It's open to the public to play from 9:30 to 7:30 daily. Sit down and enjoy, or just enjoy music someone else is playing, all month long. Calendar of events for the month can be found online at visitslo.com, and you can learn more about Arttober at slowcity.org/Arttober. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.